Right. So we're diving into a case today that I think really, makes you think about the limits of protests, United States v. Schoon. So picture this: a group of protesters, and they're not picketing outside, but inside an IRS office, splashing fake blood everywhere.
Yeah, definitely a dramatic way to make a statement. And, their choice of venue, I think, is really key here. They weren't anti-tax protesters or anything. They were demonstrating against U.S. involvement in El Salvador.
Right.
But, by choosing to target the IRS in this way, they kind of landed themselves in this legal gray area. Like, can you break one law to protest
All
another?
right, and that's where the whole idea of the necessity defense comes in.
Yeah.
So the necessity defense is the idea that, breaking the law was actually necessary to prevent an even greater harm.
Right.
But did it apply in this case? In Schoon, the Ninth Circuit had to kind of untangle that really complicated question.
Yeah. And this case is really important, I think, for anybody who's interested in the law surrounding protests, because it really sets a precedent for how courts handle what we call indirect civil disobedience.
Okay.
So these protesters weren't like directly challenging a tax law or anything, right? They were kind of using the IRS as this platform to spotlight a completely different issue.
So, yeah, set the scene for us. Like, what exactly went down on that December day back in 1989?
All right, so December 4th, Tucson, Arizona, we've got 30 protesters chanting, splashing that fake blood, just causing a huge disruption in this IRS office. They were led by Gregory Schoon, Raymond Kennon Jr., and Patricia Manning. Federal officers, come in, order them to leave, but they refuse. And that's really the crux of this whole case, They intentionally broke the law, and that ultimately led to those charges of, obstructing the IRS and disobeying federal
Right.
orders.
And at the trial, they didn't even try to deny doing it.
Right.
It was more like they were trying to justify it.
Exactly. So they invoked what we call the necessity defense. They were basically arguing that disrupting this IRS office was like their last resort to try and stop U.S. policies in El Salvador that they believed were fueling all this violence and bloodshed. So they were trying to say that their actions, were aimed at preventing something way worse.
Okay, so this actually wasn't a jury trial, though, was it? I
Yeah.
remember reading that it was actually decided by a judge, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was what we call a bench trial. So that means the judge actually determines, both the facts and the law. And in Schoon, the judge ruled that the necessity defense just didn't apply. And of course, that's what then sets the stage for that appeal up to the Ninth Circuit.
Okay, so before we actually get into what the Ninth Circuit decided, let's kind of break down a little bit of the background. What usually makes a necessity defense work? Like, what are the elements of that?
So traditionally, you need to prove four things. So first, there's imminent harm. So the danger that you're trying to prevent has to be immediate, It can't be some like vague threat that might happen in the future or something. It's got to be right now. Second, we have direct causation. Your illegal act has to actually directly prevent that harm.
So there needs to be that very clear and strong link between what you're doing, the illegal act, and stopping this bigger thing.
Exactly. And then third, whatever harm is caused by you doing this illegal act, that's got to be less than the harm that you're actually trying to prevent. So it's kind of like a balancing act.
Oh, interesting.
And then finally, you have to show that there were absolutely no legal alternatives. So you had to have tried every other way to do this legally before resorting to breaking the law.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty difficult thing to prove. Did these protesters in Schoon even come close to meeting any of those elements?
Well, that's where the Ninth Circuit really kind of threw a curveball. They actually added a fifth requirement specifically for civil disobedience cases, and it really boils down to the distinction between direct and indirect action.
Okay, this feels really crucial. Can you break down that distinction for us? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, so let's think about some classic examples. Direct civil disobedience would be breaking the actual law that you are protesting. So think Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat on the bus, directly violating those segregation laws. It's a very targeted challenge.
Okay.
Now, indirect civil disobedience is breaking a law that's unrelated to your protest, hoping that, getting publicity and attention will kind of force some sort of change. And that's actually what the Schoon protesters did. They weren't protesting tax laws specifically. It was more like they were using the IRS as the stage for their message.
And according to this Schoon case, that indirect approach is a really big problem if you're trying to use the necessity defense.
It is, absolutely. The Ninth Circuit made this sweeping statement, basically saying you can never use the necessity of defense for indirect civil disobedience. And their reasoning is really fascinating, I think. So they argued that basically The mere existence of a constitutional law cannot constitute legally cognizable harm.
So even if they truly believe that the U.S. policy in El Salvador was doing real harm, just having that policy on the books wasn't enough to justify breaking other laws in protest.
That's exactly it. And to really understand why they drew that line, we kind of need to see how the court applied those necessity elements that we talked about to the Scoom case.
Okay, yeah. So let's do that. Let's go element by element and kind of break it down. So let's start with imminent harm. Where did these protests fall short there?
So the court basically said that U.S. policies, even those that might have international consequences, they don't create this immediate emergency from a legal standpoint.
Right.
You know, creating or changing policies that takes time. It's a whole process. It's not like this instant crisis situation.
Right. So even if they were right about, you know, the harms caused by the U.S. involvement in El Salvador, the court didn't see it as something that was so immediate and urgent that it was okay to break the law.
Right. And then you also have causation. So the court really questioned how disrupting an IRS office in Arizona could actually directly stop a conflict that was happening thousands of miles away in El Salvador.
All right.
They just saw that link as way too weak, you know, too indirect.
So it's like they're saying you can't just pick any random symbolic target and then be like, oh, it was out of necessity.
Yeah.
There needs to be a much more direct link between what you're doing and the harm you're trying to stop.
Exactly. And then when you get to legal alternatives, the court emphasized that, you know, in a democracy, there are always legal ways to push for change.
Right.
You can vote, you can lobby, you can campaign for new laws, and you don't get to kind of bypass all of that just because you don't like a particular policy. So in their view, the Scoom protesters hadn't truly exhausted all of those other options.
It seems like the court was really drawing a hard line there. Just being frustrated with how slow the political process is, that's not a good enough reason to go and break the law.
That's a great way to put it. But there's actually another really big factor that weighed heavily on the court's decision, and that's this idea of jury nullification.
Jury nullification. Okay, break that down for us. What does that mean?
All right, so imagine if juries could just decide that a law was bad and then completely ignore it, regardless of what it actually said.
Right.
That's essentially jury nullification, the power to acquit someone, even if the law was very clearly broken.
Oh, wow.
So the Suasuna court was really worried that if they started letting juries decide whether or not a protest was, you know, necessary enough to justify breaking the law, well, that could open the door to this whole other kind of chaos.
So they were kind of concerned about setting this precedent where people could just start picking and choosing which laws they wanted to follow based on what they personally believed.
Exactly. They saw the necessity defense, especially in these indirect civil disobedience cases, as this kind of slippery slope that could undermine the entire legal system.
But this wasn't a completely unanimous decision, was it? I thought there was at least one judge who had kind of a different take on things.
Yeah, you're right. So Judge Fernandez actually agreed with the outcome. You know, he agreed that the protesters couldn't use the necessity defense in this case. However, he wasn't totally on board with that really broad rule that the majority created the rule against all indirect civil disobedience.
So he agreed that they lost the case, but he wasn't happy with the reasoning. So what were his concerns?
Well, he was mainly worried that shutting down the necessity defense for all these indirect civil disobedience cases was a little bit too extreme. You know, he argued that it could end up having this chilling effect on protest, even in situations where breaking the law might be morally and ethically justified. So he was basically saying that he believed there could be some very specific, rare cases where indirect civil disobedience combined with a strong necessity defense could actually be valid.
So we left off talking about how even on the Ninth Circuit, you know, you had these different opinions about the Soon case. So let's dig into Judge Fernandez's concurring opinion a bit more. I mean, he agreed with the outcome, right? He agreed that the protesters shouldn't be able to use the necessity defense, but he didn't totally agree with how they got there.
Yeah, you got it. Judge Fernandez, he believed that the Scoon protesters couldn't use the necessity defense, you know, in this specific case. But he really wasn't comfortable with this, like, blanket rule against it for all indirect civil disobedience. He seemed to be really, like, grappling with that balance between upholding the law, you know, and still protecting people's right to dissent.
Right. So it sounds like he really did see how this, like, broad rule could end up stifling some forms of protest that might actually be legitimate. So what were some of his main arguments against the rule?
Well, he argued that creating a rule that was so, like, rigid could actually have kind of a chilling effect on protests, even in situations where breaking the law might be, you know, morally and ethically justified. So he was basically saying that there could be these, like, exceptional cases where you have indirect civil disobedience and a really strong necessity defense, and it could be valid.
It does seem like a really tricky balance to strike. So how did he kind of reconcile that? You know, his concerns about protecting protests, but also making sure that the rule of law is upheld.
Well, he definitely acknowledged that there's a need for order, right? Yeah. And that upholding the law is important. But he also recognized how important protest is in our democracy, you know? And he felt that the necessity defense, while it's not usually successful, it should at least stay an option for those, like, really rare situations where somebody might truly feel like they have to break the law to prevent something really terrible from happening.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it sounds like even though he did agree with the majority's decision, you know, in the end, for the Schoon case, he was kind of advocating for this, like, more case-by-case approach, right? Not just completely shutting down the defense for all indirect civil disobedience.
Yeah, exactly. It was like he was saying, hey, let's look at each situation individually. Don't just have this automatic rule, you know? He was thinking that there could be these situations where the harm that people are protesting is just so bad, and there's such a strong connection between what they did and trying to stop that harm, that maybe in those cases the defense should be allowed.
Wow, it's really interesting to see how even within this one ruling, and you have these different viewpoints, and they're kind of wrestling with these complex issues. But I'm curious, how has Schoon been interpreted and used in the cases that came after it? Like, has it really held up as this, like, ironclad precedent?
Well, there's no doubt that Schoon has had a big impact on how courts deal with this necessity defense in protest cases. It's cited all the time, especially when it comes to these indirect civil disobedience cases. But there have been challenges, you know, and there have been attempts to differentiate some cases from that kind of rigid framework that Schoon seemed to create.
Right. And you mentioned before that some people, you know, legal experts and activists, they felt like Schoon was just too restrictive. So have there been any cases where the courts actually kind of agreed with that viewpoint?
Yeah, there have been some pretty interesting cases where courts, while they still acknowledged, you know, the precedent set by Schoon, they took a slightly different approach. So one example that really stands out is United States v. Thomas. That was a case in the Sixth Circuit, and it involved a group of protesters who actually broke into a nuclear weapons facility.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a very clear case of indirect civil disobedience, you know, to me.
Yeah.
So what made Thomas different? What did the court see in that case? Did they allow the necessity defense pop?
They did. They actually did. So the Sixth Circuit, you know, they acknowledged what Schoon had said, but they decided to really zero in on how immediate and how serious the potential harm was that the protesters were trying to prevent. So in their eyes, you know, this threat of nuclear war, that's something very unique and compelling. It's a very clear and imminent harm. And they thought that could justify breaking the law.
So even though it was an indirect protest, the court thought that the potential consequences were just so huge, so catastrophic, that it needed a different way of thinking about the necessity defense.
Exactly. And I think the Thomas case shows that, you know, Schoon is an important precedent, but it doesn't completely shut down the conversation. There's still room for courts to use their judgment, you know, and they're finding ways to apply the ideas from Schoon, but also think about the specifics of each case.
All right. So it seems like context is super important. Even when you have this precedent that seems clear, the details of what happened in the protest, how serious the perceived harm is, you know, and the arguments that are made, all of that can really affect how a court interprets and applies a case like Schoon.
You got it. That's a really good observation. And this actually brings us to all the protests that we see happening today, you know, with climate activists, social justice advocates, and all these different groups. They're often using civil disobedience to bring attention to their causes. So how does a case like Schoon, that was decided way back in 1991 and was about a very different situation, how does that apply to what's happening today?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm sure it's something that a lot of our listeners are thinking about. We've covered a lot of legal ground here, but I think it's important to talk about what it all means for the activists who are actually out there on the ground doing this work. You know, what are the practical things they can take away from Schoon? I think that's what we should explore in our last segment. So we've spent a lot of time with United States v. Schoon, but I'm really wondering now, like, what does it all actually mean for, you know, activists who are out there doing this work today? We see protests all the time. A lot of them use civil disobedience. So is Schoon kind of hanging over their heads? Does it affect them?
Yeah, it definitely brings up some big questions for modern activists. You know, Schoon makes it super clear breaking the law, even if it's for something you really believe in, it can come back to bite you. It's not enough to just feel like you're doing the right thing, you know? You really have to understand the legal side of it, especially how the necessity defense works or doesn't work.
So it's a reminder to be strategic. It's not just about like the heart and the passion behind a protest. It's also about knowing what could happen legally because of the actions you take.
Yeah, and I think Schoon actually gives us a way to think strategically. Remember those elements we talked about, the things you need to prove to make the necessity defense work? Well, Schoon highlights those, and it really shows how hard it is to win with that defense, especially when you're talking about indirect civil disobedience.
So for activists planning a protest, they need to be aware of that difference, right, between direct and indirect action, and how Schoon looks at that. So based on all of this, what advice would you give them?
The first thing I would say is really think carefully about how direct your actions are going to be. Are you breaking the actual law that you're protesting? Or are you breaking a different law, hoping it'll bring attention to the issue? What Schoon tells us is that legally, direct civil disobedience is on much stronger ground.
So it's like choosing your battles. I
Yeah.
mean, blocking a highway to protest, say, environmental policies, yeah, it'll get people's attention. But legally, is it as strong as, let's say, a sit-in at a government building, the place that's actually making those policies?
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. And even though, you know, how urgent a cause feels is important, legally, it's not everything. Schoon sets a really high bar to prove necessity. Like we said, the harm has to be happening right now. You have to directly show how your actions will prevent that harm, and you have to show that you tried everything else legally first.
It sounds like a call for activists to have both passion and a plan, right? But what about those gray areas that Judge Fernandez talked about? He seemed to say that there might be some situations where indirect civil disobedience, if you have a strong necessity defense, could actually be okay. Does that offer any hope for protest movements that are happening now?
You know, what's interesting about Judge Fernandez's opinion is that he recognized how tricky these cases can be. The law isn't always so black and white, right? And I think his argument reminds us that we have to look at each case individually, even when we have what seems like a clear precedent from a case like Schoon.
So Schoon isn't like the absolute final word. It doesn't completely shut down the necessity defense for all those indirect civil disobedience situations.
Exactly. It definitely set down a principle, but how you apply that principle well, there's room for interpretation and argument. And there are cases like Thomas where the court actually allowed the necessity defense for those protesters who broke into the nuclear facility. That shows that the context matters. How serious is the harm? How strong are your legal arguments? All of that makes a difference.
So maybe it's better to think of Schoon not as this rigid rule, but more like a jumping-off point for a bigger conversation, a conversation about where the limits of protest really are. And that's a conversation that's still going on today, right?
Yeah.
As new movements pop up and the legal landscape keeps changing.
Absolutely. It's a conversation that needs to happen. And, you know, regardless of whether you agree with what happened in Schoon or not, I think it pushes us to think critically about the balance between upholding laws, but also protecting our right to speak out against things we disagree with. It reminds us that, yeah, we have this right to protest, it's part of democracy. But with that right comes responsibility. The responsibility to know the law, to think about what might happen because of our actions, and to be part of that conversation about where the lines are drawn.
Well, United States v. Schoon is a case that, you know, really makes you think, even all these years later. It reminds us that the law isn't just this, like, fixed thing. It's always being interpreted, challenged, reshaped as things happen in the world and as society changes. Thanks for walking us through all of this. It's been a really interesting deep dive.
My pleasure, really. And I hope everyone listening got a better understanding of not just Schoon, but also all those bigger questions it raises about, you know, what protest means in a democracy.